Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks very much for the chance to speak. It's a pleasure to be able to talk today. It's a pleasure probably because it's about a question that's a really nice question with a really nice answer. And so it is a nice thing to be able to talk about. And it's a much nicer question and much nicer answer than I expected at the beginning. The question this is a joint project, I forgot to say in the abstract, with my colleague at Queen's, Ivan Dimitrov. And the question was his idea. And it is a very good question. And for months, I kept telling him that quit bothering me with this question. This must be known already. But anyway, you'll see. I'll try and explain both the question and the answer. And the setup is this, is that G is a semi-simple algebraic group. So, in fact, I don't know what everyone in the room knows, but you don't even have to know what a semi-simple algebraic group is. It's enough just to know what SLN is. And if you understand the example for SLN, everything will work out. And B is what's called the Borel subgroup. It's sort of the upper triangular matrices. So there's lots of stuff here and zeros below. And X is this geometric object, which is G mod B. So it's not, B isn't a normal subgroup. So G mod B in this case means that B acts on G on the right, and it's a fixed point free action, and you can consider G as a manifold and take the quotient. So this is a quotient, it's not a quotient of groups, it's a quotient of manifolds by B action, and it's the projective variety, and it's called the complete flag variety.
Don't go lower on
the board. Thanks. It's because, yeah, I assumed this thing wasn't here before, but when I was sitting here, I realized that. Anyway, thanks for the warning. So one way you study, in fact, I was about to go on board. So one thing that you really study projective varieties is you look at line bundles on X. So look at line bundles on X, and you can also study the cohomology So look at H0 and H1 and all the other groups. And the cohomology groups are themselves slightly mysterious. They're finite dimensional vector spaces, and we know exactly what H0 is. It's global sections. And in some good cases, we understand what H1 and H2 are. But it's hard, if you're given an element of H17, it's really hard to say what it means. But we study them anyway. It's sort of like the derivative. If you have a function, you know that its 17th derivative is positive. It's hard to really know what that means, but no one says you should stop taking derivatives at just 1 or 2. So it's the same with cohomology. We just keep going and see what they're like. So we study the cohomology on X, and there's a beautiful theorem that tells you almost everything you'd like to know about the cohomology of line bundles on X. And in some sense, one of the smart things about Ivan's question is he managed to find a question that wasn't completely answered by this theorem. And the beautiful theorem is the Borel-Weybot theorem. So it's the Borel-Weybot. And here's sort of the vague version. So to say a slightly more precise version later is for any L, there exists at most one B with the cohomology group in degree D not equal to 0. So in fact, if you look at projective spaces, then a similar thing happens. If you take a line bundle on projective space, it can have cohomology in degree 0, or it can have Pn. It can have cohomology in degree n, but it can never have cohomology anywhere in between. And furthermore, you can't pick the degree, so it has cohomology both in h0 and in hn. So it's in one degree or no degrees. The similar thing is true for these complete flag varieties, except with one slight difference is that actually any d is possible up to the dimension of the complete flag variety. So their line bundles can have cohomology in any degree, but they have cohomology in at most one degree. And furthermore, if the cohomology group is non-zero, so the group G X was constructed out of G, and one nice thing is that the group G acts on this vector space, and you could ask, then what kind of representation of G is it? Then the theorem says that this thing is an irreducible representation of G. And so the more precise theorem tells you exactly how to, given the line bundle, how to figure out the D and how to figure out the representation. And so I'll try and say what that more precise theorem is as part of the talk. But if you, that's the railway bus theorem, and it's a beautiful theorem not only because it explains the cohomology of line bundles on this particular thing, but it really, well, one of the themes of the 20th century was that we understand representation theory by finding their geometric incarnations. So, for instance, if you often, this is maybe most known in number theory, where you study representations of Galois cube over cube by finding actions on Itali cohomology. But really, that philosophy is really an important philosophy. And this is the case. This theorem produces for you all of the irreducible representations of G in the cohomology on X. In fact, I didn't say that. You can produce any, given any irreducible representation, you can produce them in any degree, sometimes in more than one way. And so it's sort of the importance of this theorem is it gives you a geometric construction of cohomology. But given this theorem, that does lead to two sort of interesting questions. And so here's the questions, or let me just set up one of the questions. So given L1 and L2 with non-zero cohomology, in degrees d1 and d2, you can look at there's a cup product map as from the tensor product of the cohomology groups into a third cohomology group. And here B is D1 plus D2, and L is L1 tensor L2. And so this is somehow one of the main, you can guess by title, main focus of the talk is this cup product map. And there's the one thing you, well, and the question, I want to study this cup product map. So I asked that, the one thing is possible, it's possible that this group here is zero, in which case I think I understand the cup product map is the zero map. So I'm going to assume that this group is not zero. And so then there's two natural questions. One is that if this is not zero, this is an irreducible representation of G. And this is a tensor product of representations of G. And this is a G-equivariant map. And so by Schur's lemma, there's only two things that could happen for this cup product map. So this is by the Borel-Weil-Bott theorem, that is the one that guarantees that these are irreducible representations, the map is either surjective or zero. And so question one is simply how to tell what happens. So when, you know, if I give you two line bundles, when is the cup product map zero and when is it not zero? So that's the first natural question. And question two is, so that's now it seems like it's a purely geometric question. And question two, I'm going to erase this very useful information. Sorry for I hope everyone's got a chance to see this very useful information. So question two is sort of similar. It's a purely representation theory question. Is given irreducible representations, V1 and V2. Suppose we consider all the line bundles L1 such that when you look at their cohomology in non-zero degree, the irreducible representation is V1. So make a big list of all the line bundles where the irreducible representation V1 appears, and we'll make a big list of all the line bundles where the irreducible representation V2 appears, and look at all the possible cup product maps we can do between them. And every time we get a surjective map, that means that we found a component, an irreducible component of this tensor product of representations of V1 tensor V2, and so you can ask for a converse question. And that is, this is a converse question, so which components? What's that? Yeah, I'm sorry, the big lists are finite, thanks. They are finite, that's right. That's not apparent from the way the vague version I've stated for the theorem, but that's true. So the big list is finite. In fact, you know exactly, it's not hard to say exactly what the number is. And you take a look at all the possible tensor products, and okay, maybe a bunch of the cup product, a lot of the cup product maps are zero, but some of them are non-zero, and so you get a component of V1 tensor V2 arrives as cup flux. So somehow, which components can you realize? So those are the two questions that I want to talk about and tell you the answer to. And none of the answers to this question weren't known before this project. And I think, except for one case, which is that if you take H0 tensor H0, it goes to H0, and it's clear that that map is not the zero map, because it's just taking two non-zero functions and multiplying them and getting something that's non-zero. So except for H0 tensor H0 and H0, sort of it wasn't known. And I think the reason it wasn't known is that nobody asked. And of course, then you could say, well, maybe nobody should have asked. So that's always a possibility, is maybe it's not a question you should ask. And so why would you care about these problems? I realize that's a somewhat dangerous question, and also subjective. But one is, I should say, is it seems natural. Okay, that's good. And two, my colleague Yvonne studies in groups, where you sort of put one group inside another and you keep going. And you can form the corresponding X's and you get sort of infinite dimensional variety that's confusing to understand. And you can look at the cohomology on this limit. The H of the limit is given by some inverse limit of cohomologies on each of the ends. And one of the particular things you could do is look at GL n going into GL 2 n, where you send a matrix G to G 0 0 G. Maybe matrix A is a better name. Oh, sorry, this is the spot I'm not supposed to write on. You just sort of double the group, and then if you try and understand what happens in this pullback map, So you just keep doubling. This goes to GL4N and GL8N. You just keep doubling these things. And if you want to understand what happens, you can factor this naturally in such a way that this cup product map comes up. So that's sort of the motivation, his motivation for this question. And the third reason is, somehow in hindsight, is that the answer turned out to be, it's connected to the Littlewood Richardson to problems about the boundary of the Littlewood Richardson polytope or cone, depending which way you want to look at it. What that means is, if you take what the Littlewood Richardson polytope is, if you take, for example, a tensor product of representations, so here I'm going to use some notation for SL3 irreducible representations. If you take V35 tensor V 1, 2, and what you do is you plot, so the irreducible representations are indexed by these vectors, and if you plot you take a tensor product and decompose it, you can sort of plot the vectors that come out, they form a shape, and in fact they, this is sort of the shape they form, and in this case, oops, I got it totally wrong, this is the shape they form, and it's known that this is kind of a strange statement to make about a finite set, but they form a convex polytope. In fact, a slightly more precise statement. But really, if you look at the things you get up to scaling, they form a convex polytope, and it's called the Littlewood Richardson polytope. And you could ask, another way to measure sort of how special a component is to ask how it sits in the Littlewood Richardson polytope. And the ones you get by cup product turn out to be always extremal. In this case, they're all the vertices. And so they're not always all the vertices. Here's sort of another picture, if I can draw it quickly, is it looks like this. So here's sort of a, this is sort of the polytope in this case. And the ones you get, the ones you get by cup product, they're always vertices, and they turn out to be these ones. So there's some vertices that are missed here. They aren't all the vertices. So you can, studying this problem, you end up with questions about the Littlewood Richardson polytope, or if you let these representations vary, you get a cone. And in fact, this part I won't talk about, but the ones you can achieve this way turn out to be sort of exactly the codimension n, where n is the dimension of this thing, faces of a liberal Richardson cone satisfying some extra condition. What's that? That's the problem. Yeah, exactly right. So these are sort of the reasons they're interested in the problem. And so my goal today is I'd like to talk about that. So these 20 minutes introducing the problem, I'd like to talk about the solution to these problems. But I thought saying what the answer is requires some vocabulary. And I thought, and rather than prove the theorems, what I thought I'd do is instead talk about the Breuil-Weybot theorem for most of the time and introduce some of this vocabulary. Before starting this project, I didn't really know anything about the Breuil-Weybot theorem or about X, these beautiful complete flag varieties. And it seemed like it would be more valuable to spend most of the time talking about that and then introduce the vocabulary and at the end to say what the answers are. So that's what I'm going to do, unless anyone violently sort of objects or would prefer I didn't talk about the Breuil-Weybot theorem or the geometry of G mod B, then that's what I'll do. So here, just to talk about, again, these beautiful theorems, because somehow that theorem is a more important theorem than our theorems, even though they was certainly true. But the theorems are the answers. I really like the answers and the questions that answer to 1 and 2, but no one would say that it's more important than the Breuil-Weybot theorem. So it seems like the best thing I could do was talk about these things for most of the talk, and then at the end, say what the answer is. So we'll need some vocabulary. And so I'm going to talk about these complete flag varieties. And again, just the case SLN plus 1, so we only have to understand the group SLN plus 1. We don't even really have to understand that much about it. So let here X is going to be the set lambda naught, lambda 1, up to lambda n minus 1, such that lambda I is an I plane in Pn, lambda I is contained in lambda I plus 1. And so this is all a big subset of, the first thing is a point, so it sits in projective space. The next thing is a Grassmannian, as a line in projective space. The next thing is a two-plane in projective space. So it sits in this product of Grassmannians. And as sort of a picture, if we were to pick n equals 3, and so I don't know, it's hard to draw, the dimension of X is slightly large, but let's just pretend this is what X looks like. And so one point on X parameterizes the data of in P3, a plane which contains a line which contains a point. And if you pick another point, this is supposed to be P3. In P3, you get a different plane and a different line and a different point. So as you move around X, you see all the possible configurations of points, lines, planes, and higher things, each one contained in the other. So it's a configuration manifold for all the subsets of linear subsets of projective space contained in each other. And it's called the complete flag variety. And in fact, this description, you can see that if you take F, so what do you need to describe a flag? You'll need a vector to describe the point. You need another linearly independent vector to describe the line, a third linearly independent vector to describe the plane. And so one of the things that describes it is a sequence of linearly independent vectors. But if you take SLN plus 1, you can take basically any basis to any other basis up to scaling one of them. And so it's clear that SLN plus 1 acts transitively on the set of possible flags. And that means by the orbit stabilizer theorem, it must be SLN plus 1 mod the stabilizer, and you just have to pick one particular flag, the one given by the basis, the standard basis, first basis vector, next basis vector, and check that the stabilizer is B. And so that shows the geometric version of the orbit stabilizer theorem shows that X is SLN plus 1 mod B. And so that's what it looks like. Okay, so that's the variety we care about. And again, it is really a beautiful variety. You can see all the Lie theory of G is sort of appears geometrically, roots and all sorts of things, but particularly the representations. And so what we need to do is let's look at some line bundles on X. And so let PRI, so this X is naturally the subset of the product, and we could look at these we could look at projections onto any one of the factors. So we could project, for instance, PR1 is projection onto the first graph, PR2 is projection onto the Grassmannian of lines. We could look at all these projections, to PRI to be the projection from X to, by my strange indexing system, gi minus 1 comma n, and that sends a tuple lambda naught through lambda n minus 1 just to the lambda I minus 1. So just send each as you move around, just send x to the appropriate linear subspace, and set li to be the pullback by the projection. Oh, I forgot to say the Grassmannian fits by the Plucker embedding in some big projective in space. And so you can take the line bundle called O of 1 on projective space, and you can restrict it to the Grassmannian, and that gives you a line bundle on a stem called O of G of 1. And so that's sort of a basis. It's all line bundles on Grassmannians are multiples of this basic one giving you a Plucker embedding. And let's just set Li to be the pullback of this bundle from the Grassmannian. And then for any lambda in Z to the N, lambda is, say, A1 up to AN, we'll let L lambda, we'll define it to be just the tensor product L1 to the A1 tensor L2 to the A2 up to LN to the AN. And so this gives an isomorphism of Zn with pick x. So pick x is all the possible line bundles on x, and so now they all have a name. The name is, to give the any line bundle on x has a name, and its name is a sequence of integers, and that's how you give them the sequence of integers, that's how you reconstruct the line bundle. And so this note by the is sort of not hard to check that so L is L lambda, sorry. One thing, I realize I'm running on the dangerous spot and I can't roll this board up. So I just note, say, lambda is greater than or equal to zero if all AI are greater than or equal to zero. And this note is that LI is what's called NEF, numerically effective, is also effective base point free. All those also nice words from geometry, if and only if this thing is greater than or equal to zero. And another useful word is that L lambda is ample if and only if very ample if and only if AI is greater than or equal to 1 for all I. And actually, the AIs are equal to 1 give you this embedding into this product of Grassmannians followed by sort of a the Segre embedding of this Plucker embedding. So anyway, that it's sort of not hard to see that this is true. So every line bundle on X has a name given by these integers. One of the most important line bundles on X is the canonical bundle, and you can work out its name. And its name turns out to be just a bunch of minus 2. So X in algebraic geometry terms has this thing called Fano, and that just means that if you take the dual of this line bundle, changing all the integers to positives, that it's ample. And that just follows from all the things being greater than or equal to 1. And there's this very nice and important theorem, the Kodaira vanishing. Once you know that it's Fano, if lambda is greater than or equal to 0, then HD of XL lambda equals 0 for all D greater than or equal to 1. So this is a special case of Borel's A. In fact, you sort of use this plus one other beautiful construction of De Mazur to prove the Borel's A bot there. So let me say, one thing I'd like to tell you is, so now we know a name for all the line bundles on the name for all the line bundles on X, and the Borel's A bot theorem says that there's at most one D where the cohomology group is non-zero. And so given a line bundle that is knowing its name is the sequence of integers, I'd like to say how you find the D that where it's non-zero. And so given lambda is the sequence of integers, A1, AN, let's set AI prime to be AI plus 1, for I is 1 to N. And form a triangle. So the triangle looks like this. You write A1 prime, then you write A2 prime, you write them all down to AN prime, and then you write A1 prime plus A2 prime, and beside it, A2 prime plus A3 prime. And it's not quite Pascal's triangle. The next step, you don't add these two. Instead, you add A1, A2, and A3 prime. So the next one is A1 prime plus A2 prime plus A3 prime, and you keep going until you get down to the sum of all of the AI primes. That's the vertex of the triangle. And what matters is just if the entries are positive, negative, or zero. And that's the only crucial thing to know. So let me just do two examples to try and illustrate what the procedure is. I realize since it's adding one and adding numbers, it's not such a complicated procedure, but it's still useful in these cases to see something. And this triangle is the key to the answers to many of the questions. So I'm going to pick minus 5, 2, 4, and then we start off with by adding one to each of these things. So minus 4, 3, 5. This is a good point that for everyone to make sure that I don't make a mistake. It involves addition, and then 4. Okay, great. Okay, so there's the triangle. And again, what matters at the end is just the signs. So I'm going to write minus, plus, plus, minus, plus, and plus. So it's that pattern of signs is sort of the key part. And here's the second example. Lambda is minus 4, 2, 4. And then I'm going to add one to these things. Minus 3, 3, 5, and 0, 8, and 5. And so the pattern associated to these things is minus, plus, plus, zero, plus, plus. And so this diagram by itself decides what happens sort of to the cohomology. And the rule is that I'll go back to this diagram in a sec, but the rule is that if the minus signs that are important in this picture, and also the zero is slightly important, but so the minus signs are important. Is the rule is that so if a zero appears, HD XL equals zero for all D. So zero means really zero. If you see a zero there, then the cohomology is zero for all D. So if not, then HD XL is not equal to zero for D equals the number of minus signs. And so in this case, this is something, there's two minus signs and no zeros. So this is a case where H2 of XL is not equal to zero. And this is HD equals zero for all D. So that's the rule. And for any line bundle L, this is not exactly the right notation I should be using, but it's good for remembering what the thing is supposed to mean. It's going to be important to sort of know what the signs are, what the diagram is attached to each line bundle, and to remember it came from a triangle. I'm just going to use a nabla. It's not the right symbol. There should be a different symbol there. B the subset of places in the triangle with negative signs. And the Picard group of X is partitioned by the sign diagram. And so here's sort of a here's that picture. So I just want to walk around the Picard group of X and try and draw the sign diagram for a second, see what it looks like. So here's an example. For n equals 2, here's what the picture looks like. So this is the Picard group, n equals 2. So here's all the, this is the origin. There, so this is, it's isomorphic to Z2. So pick X is isomorphic to Z2, and so this is isomorphism I'm using to draw the picture. So here are all the things where the coordinates are greater than or equal to 0, and their sign diagram is just three triangles with a plus, and these are all the things that have H zeros. And down here are the things that have sign diagram plus, minus, plus, and they all have H1s, right, H1s. Here are things with the sign diagram plus, minus, minus. These are things with H2s. Over here, this is applying third duality. These are things with sign diagrams minus, minus, minus. Those are all the things with H3s. The slag variety in this case is three-dimensional. So H3 is the worst you can get, as you can sort of see by the slags. And finally, there's two more things over here where it's minus, plus, plus. These are things with H1s. And these are things with minus, plus, minus. These are things with H2s. So there's sort of a little picture of the Picard group of X divided by sine diagram when n equals 2. And so it gets more confusing when there's more, n is bigger, but that's always the way things go. except for maybe the Poincaré conjecture. So I should say the dotted lines are where the cohomology is 0. So that's sort of a picture of Picard group of X. And one problem I didn't mention at the beginning is I said that I only want to consider cup product problems. You want to take something non-zero, tensor something non-zero, going to something non-zero. And you could have asked, well, how do you arrange? I better arrange things so that the third thing is non-zero. And how do you do that? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know how to give you conditions so that that given the first two line bounds, the third one is non-zero. And it's sort of a cone. We thought we knew the answer, but we're wrong. I'll tell you what we thought it was in a minute. It's sort of a cone problem. For instance, if I want to, if I tried to get an H1 into H2, I'd have to take something in here and something in there and add it. The origin is here, and add it in such a way they end up in either here or here, and that's not possible. Or I could take something here and something here and add them to either end up in there and there, and that's not possible. In this case, you can take something in H1 and H2 and end up in H3. That's a possible thing to do. But so there's this problem I don't know the answer to, a combinatorial problem, just to classify. It's not clear it's totally interesting, but there are some related questions to this problem that would be cleared up by knowing the answer to that problem. I don't know the answer. So that's anyway, it is a sort of related problem. Okay. So what is the Borel-Weil I better start on a new. So what is the, maybe I'll briefly say what the Borel-Weil Bott theorem is. I was going to prove it, but maybe for make sure I end exactly on time, I won't try and prove it. There's a beautiful proof starting from the H0 fact using something called Z-Mizer reflection. It's very short. It's under 3 minutes somehow once you know what a Z-Mizer reflection is. But, yeah. In any case, I would say, if you've worked with the Weil group or things like that before, you may have said, well, I've drawn the diagram wrong. Because this actually, you can sort of see that there might be a group acting on here that permutes these chambers. In fact, there is. The Weil group in this case is the symmetric group of order of S3 of psi 6. And these things are all, the Weil group acts and permutes these chambers. If I sort of drew it in different axes, it would look like a hexagon and it would sort of be perfectly symmetric. But the natural sort of geometric axes don't give you that picture. And that's the one I picked for this drawing. So Let me briefly mention the Relvay Bott theorem. Actually, mostly I've said everything we know already on theorem of A. First, I should say that recall that irreducible representations of SLn plus 1 are classified by integers. Mu is b1 to bn such that the bi's are greater than or equal to 0. That's the classification, the highest weight method of classifying representations. And given lambda is a1 through an, lambda greater than or equal to 0, that is, all the i's are greater than or equal to 0, h0 of xl lambda is not equal to 0. And that's one of the things that I mentioned at the beginning. If these things are non-negative integers, this is a non-zero group. By the Borel-Weil-Bott theorem, it must be an irreducible representation of G. That means it must be classified by some sequence of integers, b1 through bn, which are non-zero, or greater than or equal to 0. So you may say, well, what could that sequence be? So to sort of repeat the problem, we're given a sequence of integers greater than or equal to 0. We produce a line bundle. We get a representation. The Borel-Weil-Bott theorem tells us it's irreducible. It's got irreducible representations also have a name. They're classified by a sequence of integers, also each of them greater than or equal to 0. What could that name be? So it's not hard to check that HD of X lambda, well, in a perfect world, you'd guess that it was just the same sequence. But actually, it's that same sequence in reverse, which is the representation dual. And so either the moral lesson is either it's the reverse or the dual of the perfect world, I guess is what you can get out of that. So it's not the one you expect. But the Borel-Weil-Bott theorem then is that I'll omit some part of the notation. I'll just basically going to repeat what it was before with some mild. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It was true, but it would be much better to say zero. Okay, so it's dual references. So knowing that detail is not important. I just wanted to, even though I'm not going to give an exact statement of Borel-Weil-Bott, indicate enough to sort of figure out what the right statement is. And so the theorem is the Borel-Weil-Bott theorem is that given L lambda, so the key points are this thing is not equal to zero in at most 1 degree if non-zero HD XL lambda is an irreducible representation of G. And so we find the last thing, so those are the things we wrote before. The question is, how do you find D and how do you find the representation? So find D by number of minus signs. Find representation by acting by the vowel group until you get to a zero chamber, and then the representation is the same. That is, if I happen to pick a line bundle over here, one of these tuples of integers that land me in this H2 cone, I know that its cohomology is on zero in degree 2, but I want to know what representation it is, and I act by the vowel group till I get around here into the H0 part, and I look what thing I got, and I use that rule over there. So that's an amount. So it sort of takes a bit more notation to write out. It's not so complicated, but it seems easier to say what the principle is. Okay, so at this point I'm ready to say almost what the what the answer is, but I have to show you one more example, which sort of one more important condition, which is to do with the signs. So here's the Important condition is the lining up of signs. And so here I want to look at two examples of cut product problems, which I wrote on the board ahead of time to save some time, but I guess I could have just written them right now. Anyway, here's two examples of potential cut product problems. I depict this is a 1, 2, 3, 4, so this is an SL6 problem, and this is an SL7 problem. And here there's two minus signs, so this is an H2, and here there's four minus signs, so that's an H4. And the end one, the sum of these two things, the tensor product rule is that when you tensor product the line bundles, you just add their names. Just add the vectors. So here pick two vectors, their sum is another vector, and this has six minus signs, so that's an H6. And so that's a perfectly good tensor product. Both sides of this problem are non-zero, and so there's the question, is this surjective or not? And this is a problem where there's, here's an H3, tensor in H3 going to an H6. So these are both problems into H6, which seems mysterious enough by itself, and they're both cases where both sides are non-zero. And so there's a case where we have an actual question. We want to know what the answer is. And so I said I didn't know how to solve this. So one thing, to get an actual problem where both sides are non-zero, you need to arrange things so that the number of minus signs here plus the number of minus signs here is the number of minus signs here. And one way you could do this is if the minus signs here happen to be the disjoint union of these minus signs. So in this case, it's true that if I call this L, and I'll call this short notation, L1, L1 and L2, that the sign diagram for L, that is the subset of minus signs, is the disjoint union of the sign diagram for L1 and L2. And here, it's not. But you still get a perfectly legitimate problem. So our guess at the beginning was you could only arrange both sides to be non-zero if the first thing happened. And that's not true. Which is a surprise. Because you make a wrong guess and then you find out you're wrong. I'm personally surprised, but other people may not have been surprised. So it took a while to find this one. For Schubert, this is a rather obscure comment. For Schubert calculus fans, the smallest Schubert product where you see something non-zero is if you take this, and in the expansion, somewhere you see 2 times times this thing, plus other stuff. And sort of rather cryptically, I'll just say that if you happen to look at this diagram, you see exactly those things. Somehow, I found that example through Schubert calculus by looking for something where it's non-zero. Okay, so anyway, the important condition, this condition will be important, and then so now I can say, in fact, what the first thing is, what the results are. The answer to the first question, we already know, and this is a theorem 1, is that the cut product map HD1 XL1 tensor HD2 XL2 to HD XL. Again, D is D1 plus D2. L is L1 tensor L2. It's surjective. That is non-zero if and only if, let's isolate it from the formula, if and only if the sign diagram for L is the disjoint union of the sign diagram for of L1 and L2. So now the answer, actually, after all that, the answer is actually quite simple. So in this case, to know whether cut product is surjective or not, you just write down the diagram. In this case, so this is surjective, and this is the zero map. So the answer is really quite simple. Okay, so, yeah?
That fits with your guess, right?
That fits with the guess.
Okay.
That's right.
So the guess was that the number of signs could only out of right if you have this condition.
Right.
That was wrong, but it was still the right idea.
That's right. Yeah, that's correct. I mean, yeah, so we were somehow lucky at having the right wrong guess at the beginning. So the second question is also short, but I need to introduce one other piece of terminology, and that's representation terminology, and that's a PRV component. So in a tensor product, so given, mu1, mu2 greater than or equal to zero, i.e., names of irreducible representations, v mu1, v mu2, then v mu is called a PRV component of V mu1 tensor V mu2 if and only if there exists W1, W2, and W in the Vala group. In our case, it's just a symmetric group such that W acting on mu is W1, mu1 plus W2. Mu2. So it's kind of like a linear equation involving a mu is where the group acts on it. And so here's that picture is nice. I hate to erase it, but I guess it's got to go. I'll just say a brief example. If we take the tensor product, and this is an SL2 example of V11 tensor V11, and decompose it, decomposes as V00 plus V03 plus two copies of V11. Usually just write a 2 in there, but plus V30 plus V22. And so that's, so if we S1 be the sort of simple reflection that reflects two things, that reflects the first two, and S2 to be the reflection that reflects the other ones, so that S2 acts on 1, 1, it's minus 1, 2, and symmetrically, S2 acting on 1, 1 is 2 minus 1. And so, if we pick W is the identity, W1 is the identity, W2 is S1, we get W1 acting on 1, 1 plus W2 acting on 1, 1 is equal to the identity acts as identity plus minus 1, 2 is 0, 3. And so you can see 0, 3 is a component of this tensor product, and so that's one of the, this is a PRV component. But you could also, if you let W equals the identity, W1 S1, W2 is F2, then if you do this equation again, W1, 1, 1 plus W2, 1, 1, you get minus 1, 2 plus 2 minus 1, which is 1, 1. So these things are also PRV components. So it's not obvious that if it's not obvious to me. It may be obvious to other people that if mu actually satisfies such an equation, then it has to show up as a product, as a component of the tensor product. So something is not so easy to prove. So you have to prove it. And they do. So the story I should say it's a theorem. I'm sorry. It was a conjecture open for 20 years that this would be true. That if you had such an equation, it would be a component of the tensor product. And it was proved by first proved by Kumar and Matthew independently. And since then, there've been a lot of different proofs, as you can see it through crystal bases. And there's a whole bunch of proofs of this thing. But for at least 20 years, that was not a known fact. The first proof was through geometry, using the geometry of G mod B. And so, I'll leave the diagram up and just tell you what the result is. That theorem two is that a component of V mu1 tensor V mu2 can be realized via cup product if and only if the mu is a PRV component of stable multiplicity 1. That is to say, i.e., the multiplicity of V M, if you scale in you not only want it to be a component, so you want the multiplicity of the component to be 1, but you want it to be 1 not only in the sort of after scaling all these things. And so in particular, this V11, which is the PRV component, could not possibly be one of these things because it already appears in multiplicity 2 here. And this one appears as multiplicity 1 in this tensor product, and it appears, I mean, 3-0 is also a, actually in this case it's kind of a strange example because they're sort of all PRV components. They're sort of too small. But the number of PRV components is at most the number of the vowel groups, so actually sometimes they're small. But one, to finish, it's time to finish, is that in the type A case, it's especially nice. Statement you can make is by a conjecture of Fulton proved by Tao, Knudsen, and Woodward, is that in type A case, that is, for example, in the SLM plus 1 case, a component is multiplicity 1 if and only if it's a stable multiplicity 1. So for the type A case, the answer is just that it's realizable if and only if it's a PRV component of multiplicity 1. The stable is taken care of by it there. So in this case, this is a multiplicity 1. It appears just once, and that's realizable by cohomology. This one is 2 symmetrically. These ones are 2. And but the other one is not. And so that's the answer in general, and that's the end of my time.